the Methodist Episcopal Church and women's concerns in the nation. The second respondent will be Dean James Costin, who is the Dean of Johnson C. Smith Theological Seminary at ITC. Olivia, welcome. The floor is yours.
Thank you, Dr. Omar. The first week in September, Dr. Omar called me up and said, Olivia, we need you. And anytime a man of that quality does that, that appeals. Paper on black women in ecclesiastical and ecumenical concerns for black church, because my schedule then was already crazy, and as I get older, I don't have any more energy than you do, sometimes less. So what I share with you today comes out of two sources: my own years in the black church. They made an interesting comment. He said, Olivia, you're a black national Baptist, and I know that paper's going to be loaded that way. I make no apology for being a black Baptist, because as I look around the black church, everybody's copying from bad and good. But I want to congratulate the society on taking the initiative to go into the think tank relative to the black woman. Because outside of this group that's beginning to do that as scholars, there are very few people doing this. And I had a fascinating 3 days last week, a week before last, up in the Rochester area. I'm sure the spillout from Colgate Rochester had something to do with the quality of the retreat that I was a participant in. But it was the first time I had ever seen, participated in, or directed, and was directed by God and the women, in a retreat where women looked at their role in the black church not as financiers, but as Christian advocates in an unchristian society. So that today, when you consider black women, I'm happy. I was sorry not to be here last night to hear Dr. Mitchell Heller present her paper. And this morning I got in when Dr. Murray was presenting her paper. And when she was presenting all of this theory, I could think only of her professor, Dr. George Johnson, who was dean of the law school at Howard, who was my boyfriend at the time that she was a student at Howard. Now, she's as old as I am, but she went to Dale later. George used to say to me, Paula is undoubtedly the most brilliant student I've ever had. And she was studying at Yale at the time. Also, she was commuting, and I kept saying, I guess he was right when I heard what she was presenting this morning. I'm not going to critique what I felt I heard. I'm going to present my own paper. But you ought to be congratulated on opening up another irritant in the field of scholarship. The challenge presented by the Planning Committee in seeking to explore knowledge of black women and ecclesiastical concerns of the black church is evident when it's discovered that a major study in 1972 of black women in white America by Gerda Lerner, which is published by Random House, had no research or any data on black women's role in the black church. It's unbelievable to me that any scholar in American society could do a book on black women without church. But it is a critique of our time that a white woman writing on black women did not know because of isolation of the central role in the life of the black woman or the black church. Black women as church women have been invisible in most black history sources. As early as 1912, in the Negro Yearbook, edited by Monroe Wirt, published at Tuskegee Institute by them, much valuable information and biographies of black women were noted, but not as church women. Dr. Jean Noble, a young woman, a modern scholar now, a distinguished black educator, in her excellent chapter, American Negro Women, written for the Negro Reference Book, published by Prentice Hall in 67, omitted black church women as a significant category of American black women. Now that's another interesting commentary. She represents the black woman intellectual, of which there are not many in the black church. So that her isolation from an institution of her heritage focuses her writing on the sociological, not on the religious. The many anthologies and biological compilations concerning black women suffer from a major defect. They list only black famous women who have achieved significantly over and above the role of housewife and mother. The black history studies through which we are enriched accurately reflect the second-class position of black women during much of United States history and totally obscure the historical significance of the black church and its main supporters, the black church women. Contemporary history is tending to include famous black women as real pathbreakers, trendsetters, and influential leaders, but never from the perspective of the black church or black religion. A study of the list of famous black women in general American black history by both white and black historians and authors will reveal the neglect of this subject. While there is beginning to be discovered an abundance of primary source materials readily available on many famous black women, it bears little relationship to their actual importance in black history, and also almost none to their role in the religious life and institutions and the black church. The YWCA being the one exception, and it is referred to, the Y, as a white organization with black women inside. That's the way history is referring to the Y. The following partial list of famous black women is a selection of the best in black history, all of whom have been deeply involved in the black church, but usually no mention is made of its contribution to their lives. Marian Anderson, Maggie Walker, Nannie Burrow, Shirley Chisholm, Fannie Lou Hamer, Sojourner Truth, Ethel Waters, Mary McLeod Bethune, Mahalia Jackson, Harriet Tubman, Charlotte Hawkins Brown, Elizabeth Ross Haynes, Dorothy Irene Height, and we could go on. It was after the civil rights struggle of the 60s that white America discovered the history of black people. Its and beginning to ask those questions that will inform the Black church and Black history about the contributions of Black women. Black church women have been victimized twice. First, by scholarly neglect and being treated as inferior by Black males. And secondly, as inferior in an American racist society. Black males have been considered inferior in the American society, but Black church women have been doubly invisible. For historians and writers sought only for Black women of achievement, giving no recognition to the impact of the Black church on their life or to their role in it. The records of most Black church women, their concerns, their religious viewpoints, their contributions to the historical liberation and freedom struggle, today lie buried, if written at all, and scattered in the archives of local churches and denominational files where existent, and many have never been edited or seldom published. Where Black church women have been organized denominationally, the records are equally scattered, unclassified, and unused. This paper is an attempt to reflect, recall, and pull together some of the Black church woman's history of my lifetime. It has been my good fortune to be a very active participant observer in the Black church and history for the past 50 years from my early childhood. As this conference and the studies that follow focus on the history and value of the Black church woman, another varied facet of Black experience in the Black church will be brought to light and light. Today's Black churchmen as scholars will hopefully recognize the omissions and distortions of the past, and in their findings and interpretations on the Black church, give new knowledge to the role, leadership, and viewpoint of Black church women. Recently, I had a long conference with one of the top executives at Lilly Foundation, and was reviewing, at his request, a lot of the proposals that had been presented on the Black church. And the interesting omission, and the reason the conference was initiated was because I had proposed something on the Black church woman. The interesting omission in the studies that are being done on the Black church was the absence of a significant input on the Black church woman. The largest grant being given by Lilly Foundation at the moment has no basic reference regarding the Black church to the Black church woman. Lilly Foundation suddenly discovered this, and while they're not going to correct that mistake, they're going to, you know, add something else. So their record will be good. Black church would be the first to acknowledge, Black clergy would be the first to acknowledge that were it not for Black church women, there would be no Black church. This has been historically true. And we've meeting scholarship studies all over the world. But that mass of Black women back there are supporting what is known as the Black church. And you can say on this side, the white one too. Black church women would proclaim that we've come this far by faith, for even within the church, we are almost totally invisible in major decision making, in positions of policy making, and in the position of ministry. I have to tell you an interesting story. Recently, I spoke, it was last May, for a large church in transition the mainline Protestant churches, United Methodist, United Presbyterian, Presbyterian USA, Protestant Episcopal Reformed Churches, the American Baptist, which is almost black now, the United Church of Christ, the Seventh-day Adventist Church, the Churches of God, and thirdly, the inner city, storefront black churches, such as the Holiness and the Pentecostal. And into this mix in 1897 came the Church of God in Christ. And fourthly, black Christians within the Roman Catholic Church. For the purposes of this presentation, black church ecclesiastical concerns will be limited to the first two categories, the predominantly black church and the black churches within the mainstream white Protestant churches. The organizing pattern that I've chosen and feel would best provide us with an overview of black church women's ecclesiastical concerns is a historical one. Six historical periods have been chosen by me, and I'm going to try to analyze the role of women in each of these periods. This paper could have gone a dozen different ways if I'd had some time and some research assistance, but this is the one that came, and I want to share this. The first period is the early slave era from 1619 to 1775. Africans who were sold to the United States as slaves, not to the country, but to the colonialists as slaves, in this period came from tribes that had well-developed religions. Religion played a large and significant part in their lives. These Africans believed in the traditional religions of their tribes and believed in spirits, good and bad, in animism, and had an animistic faith by and large during that period. They believed usually in one dominant or father spirit who is the creator, the ruler, and the protector. For the first 100 years, converting slaves to Christianity was highly controversial, despite the fact that Africans took so readily to the Christian religion because their previously highly developed religious life on their own continent. Almost nothing is recorded about women slaves and their religious concerns. However, despite all the good work of John Hope Franklin, my good friend. However, after 18 study seminars on the African continent, which I have conducted since 1958, among more than 18 nations and their many tribes, there are over 815 tribes on the continent of Africa, which is 4.5 times the size of the United States. I feel that three religious concepts concerning African slave women need to be shared as a part of our discussion. The first one is faith. Traditional, then in this culture, Christian. The second concept is family welfare, and the third, human dignity, or an aspect of freedom for which they had been stolen or sold. One only has to experience life in the extended family in Africa and experience the place of religion in tribal life to know that these are major, if unconscious, ecclesiastical concerns of black women. The second period is from 1776 to 1865, and I call this the development of black churches. That period is when our churches were basically born. The earlier years of this period, from 1776 on, for some time marked the arrival of the evangelists, whites, the Methodists, the Baptists, and the Presbyterians, and they felt slavery was wrong and openly preached against it as abolitionists. They were zealous to evangelize young America and give great attention to the life and condition of the growing numbers of slaves. And in 1870, the Methodists required all itinerant pastors to set their slaves free. And in 1789, a Baptist convention declared slavery is a violent depreciation of the rights of nature and recommended that local missions extrapolate their horrid evil in the early evangelistic drive, such as the Great Awakening and the Great Revival, and the simplicity of the evangelistic faith and the emotionalism of the early evangelical leaders did much to determine the nature of black worship, because like Africans, the new believers were in a religion that was characterized by such phenomena as laughing, weeping, shouting, dancing, jerking, prostration, and speaking in tongues. These were elements common to the Africans from Africa. They found them in the evangelists, and they joined and followed in the faith. Africans regarded these as evidence of the spirit in man's heart. And this high emotionalism, characteristic of the frontier religion, became a part of the black church, where black oppressed people expressed their feelings of dependence on God only, not on their slave masters. The slave master was cruel and held slaves as property. From the period of 1782 to 1835, from the slave ranks came black preachers. Black Henry, in 1782, who traveled with the Methodist Bishop Asbury, was a great preacher. David George, in 1775, was the first preacher of the Negro Baptist Church of Silver Bluff, South Carolina. George Lyle of Burke County was an eloquent preacher to the blacks and whites. Andrew Bryan of Georgia, 1737 to 1812, was founder of the first African Baptist Church in Savannah. And John Chavis, in 1801, Presbyterian missionary to slaves. These black preachers and leaders of ability kept alive the aspiration among black people. The black preacher made religion the people's ground of hope. One can imagine that slave women followed gladly, supporting Richard Allen as he founded the AME Church in 1787 and became its first bishop in 1816. And the AMEZ, founded by James Barrett in 1796, who in 1821 became its first bishop. The African culture is a male-dominated culture, then and now, and the woman is very supportive of her male. This cultural determinant provided the black church with slave women supporting the religious leaders and the leads of their great preachers, who held their people away from segregated white, who led their people away from segregated white churches to black houses of dignity before God for their followers. Sojourner Truth belongs to this period and best represents the faith of black church women. In her challenge to Frederick Douglass in Faneuil Hall, Boston, she said this: but Douglass was in this mood. He was despondent. He orated long on the slavery question. He talked about the wrongs being done to his people. He advocated force as the only solution. And he said, to have colored men take up arms was unthinkable, but there seemed no other way out. And into this mood of despair and quandary, it seemed from nowhere a voice, apparently from the balcony, Frederick, is God here? Sojourner asked. The effect was terrific. The meeting's atmosphere changed. Hope replaced fear. Optimism returned. Sojourner Truth acquired distinction and fame in the religious community. She fought for unpopular causes. One such trial led to a scandal because of her religious activities. Desiring to protect her good name, Sojourner secured one of the most able lawyers of the day and entered into what became one of the most celebrated cases of libel in American law annals. Two volumes were written in her defense, and as a result, she was vindicated. The experience left her very unhappy because of the smear on her character. Though she had won the case, time only could polish her good reputation back to its original brightness as a woman who saw truth from God. The entire episode revealed her as a woman of integrity, imagination, faith in the legal process as well as in her God. And again, she had proven herself to be no ordinary woman. Previous victorious experiences with seeking justice through legal redress had been a major battle for Sojourner when she tried to get her son back into the state of New York after having been illegally sold outside of She won our son back. Her faith in the justice of the court led her after this to remark, "Why? I feel so tall." Within, I felt as if the power of a nation was with me. By mid-century, her fame had spread. This fearless Christian woman decided to journey to Ohio to attend a women's rights movement convention. And those who often championed women's rights were frequently also the fighters against slavery. The women were afraid that the two issues would become confused when they saw Sojourner enter the auditorium. The white women were afraid. They were panic-stricken. She must not be allowed to speak. They were working for women's rights, not civil rights. Sojourner was nationally known as a fighter for the abolition of slavery. And their conference must confine itself to one problem only, women's rights. The gallery was filled with clergy and other men opposed to sexual equality. And Sojourner seated herself on the steps of the speaker's platform, all 6 feet of her. The first day she listened, the men were not convinced. The despondency of the delegates caused her on the second day to stand up and start for the platform. There was a thunder of disapproval. Undaunted, she moved on. The chairman, knowing not what to do, said, "Sojourner has a word." She addressed her words to the men. "That little man says a woman can't have as much right as a man because Christ wasn't a woman." Sounds like a quote. "What did your Christ come from? Where did your Christ come from? And then she thundered, "Your Christ came from a woman, from God and a woman. Men had nothing to do with him. The house rose." In other words, she concluded her address by saying, "If the first woman, Eve, that God ever made was strong enough to turn the world upside down all alone, then women together ought to be able to turn the world right side up again. And if we are asking to do it, the men had better let us." The men had no answer. The day had been saved, and men seemed convinced that women should have some right. And the women who had so strongly opposed her stood to cheer long and loud. Sojourner lived from 1789, or in the period between 1797 and died in 1883. But during the period of 1797 to 1883, she clearly speaks to the continuing ecclesiastical concerns of deep religious faith, love of family, which she fought for legally, justice in the courts of a democratic nation, and human rights for women as well as for men. She must have inspired thousands of black church women before she died at the age of 86 in 1883. The other giant of hope and faith during the period of 1823 to 1913 was Harriet Rose Tubman, the conductor of the Underground Railroad and a spy for the Union troops in the Civil War. This historic woman, who made 19 successful trips into slave territory to lead 300 faith women to freedom, exemplifies the black church woman's protest of slavery and her work for its abolition. The third period of history that I've chosen to look at is the period between 1865 and 1914. And I call that Emancipation and Negro Education. Booker T. Washington, in describing his mother's reaction to news of the Emancipation Proclamation, said, "My mother, who was standing by my side when I learned the news, and when she learned it, leaned over and kissed her children, while tears of joy ran down her cheek. She explained to us what it meant, that this was the day for which she had been praying. She represented thousands of black church women who had worked for its coming, the Emancipation Proclamation. The South found new ways to enslave the recently emancipated, but black women never lost faith During this period, the black state conventions were organized in North Carolina in 1866, Atlanta and Virginia in 1867, and in 1870. Soon all the states had some form of organized religion, mostly under the leadership of the Baptists. The AME Church founded seven institutions of learning, secondary schools and colleges, and the CME Church built three colleges. Concern for spiritual needs and growth of black youth and the limited opportunities for vocational pursuits provided the motivation for black church women to support and undergird black colleges. Black church women raised the funds to support our black Christian colleges. A graduate research project on how black women raised funds in innovative ways to sustain these colleges would be a real contribution to today's black youth and a testimony to the commitment of black Christian church women to higher education of black youth. Black Christian colleges were also established during this period by committed mainline Christians and predominantly white denominations from the North. Hampton Institute, Morehouse College, Spelman, Fisk, Howard, were some colleges established by those major religious denominations, including the American Baptist Missionary Association, Congregational, and its own Daniel Hand Fund. Black Baptists, AMEs, CMEs, established and supported, among many, Zion Wesley Institute, Lane College, Allen University, Payne College, and you know the other list. Who can doubt that the deep concern of black church women for the education of their youth, inspired such philanthropists as Carol Phelps Stokes, or the Stokes-Phelps Fund, Julius Rosenwald, the DuPonts, John Rockefeller, John F. Slater, the Dukes of North Carolina, George Peabody, John A. Whitney, and Andrew Carnegie, to give to the education of black youth. Lost to history is the list of most of these black Christian women who dedicated their lives to the support of black higher Christian education. Christian women like Mary Jane Patterson in 1862, who was the first black woman to receive a BA degree from Oberlin College, and Lucy Laney, founder of Haynes Normal Institute in Augusta, Georgia, and Mary Church Terrell, the first black woman to serve on a board of education, and Mary McLeod Bethune, the founder of Bethune-Cookman College, and that great National Baptist woman, Nanny Helen Barber, founder of the National Trade and Professional School for Women here in Washington, are but a few of the great black Christian women educational innovators who came from the black church and sought and secured the continued support of black church women for the educational institutions, programs, and causes that they founded. When I was 10 years of age, sitting in the Abyssinian Baptist Church, where I had come when I was 8, from a huge farm in North Carolina, Mary McLeod Bethune was a speaker in our church on our $52,000 marble pulpit. And she stood up there as black as aces, and said to us with her hands on her hip, "I am the most beautiful thing you will ever see, and the most beautiful woman you will ever look at." My mother, sitting there with four of us as her children found us sneakering, she leaned across us and put her hands and said, "Beauty is inside. We'll talk about this at home." To be remembered but unsung are those millions of black Christian women who joined the NACP, the National Council of Women, and other community organizations working for equality, justice, the rights to vote, equal opportunity for themselves, their fellow men, and their black children and youth. Let's recall the unknown hundreds of thousands of black church women who serve as church school teachers, one-room public school teachers, choir directors, pianists, leaders of women's auxiliaries in local churches and their denominations, and whose Christian faith sustained and inspired them environment of vice, crime, and general social behavior, asocial behavior. The least educated found city problems and pressures often overwhelming. The black church, the one rural institution, brought in its entirety north, moved north, and became a second home, a center for emotional relief from racism and oppression, a socio-political center to aid in the struggle against lynching and the fight for equality, and a launching pad for the talented and the fellowship extended family environment for social life. The black church was flourished in the purchasing of Jewish synagogues and the creation of beautiful buildings and attendance at Sunday morning services, afternoon and evening, and night services. White mainline denominations and the Federation of Churches, United Church of Women, the Federal Council of Churches, all had departments during this period of Negro work or race relations secretary. The United Christian Youth Movement, a very strong Protestant interdenominational youth movement, began in the late 30s, had a black AME young adult as its first national president, Martin L. Harlan, now dead. Harlem, New York had a dynamic Harlem Christian Youth Council, which I served as president from 43 to 49, while also serving as secretary of the United Christian Youth Movement of America, 43 to 46. Black churches had extensive foreign mission programs in Africa, in Nigeria, in Ghana, Liberia, and the West Indies. The black church women raised, often by way of the kitchen and those good soul food dinners, funds to support the unsaved in Africa, the new converts to the mission areas that the church wanted to work with. On the domestic front, black church colleges were a special financial concern for CME, the AME, and the AMEZ. The YWCA was receiving many well-educated, religiously oriented young women as professional staff for work in black churches, as the black church had no professional positions then and few now for women. A few local council of churches across America began in the middle 40s to consider blacks for programmatic and executive leadership. In 1941, neither the national black or white denominations, not the Federal Council of Churches, had any top black women in its volunteer board or top programmatic or administrative boards or staff. The six black denominations, as members of the National Council of Churches, sent their bishops or clergy almost totally to represent their church. Racial integration was the socio-religious democratic goal of the NAACP, the goodwill efforts of the churches in which black women played a significant part. The depression of the 30s hit blacks in the cities very hard. They were the last hired in the first fire. And while black men found jobs hard to get to support their families, black women moved ahead, working as domestics and factory workers, teachers and nurses, supporting their black families, never losing hope. Many black parents with little education showed great faith in the value of education and supported black church colleges in an effort to improve their children's lot. The next period I wish to discuss, or the fifth period, is called Urbanization of the Black and Growth of the Black Church. Maybe the United Church Women's World Community Day theme for 1957 might best symbolize the period from 1942 to 1960. That theme was Bread, Freedom, and Dignity. Black college youth had this as their goal. Achieve, remember, is one woman black in the midst of this United Church movement. There are a few blacks there. It is my opinion that you are filled with fear. What are you afraid of? We Negro women are asking that you know us better, and then you will not be afraid of us. No one of us made ourselves. If you have any quarrel to make, do not quarrel with us. Find fault with God who created.
we should not clutter up the earth with ourselves. I wonder if the women of the United Council of Church Women have backbone enough to return to their communities and put into action the many fine statements that have been made in all these conferences we have been holding. We are wasting time and money if we continue to come to these meetings, listen to discussions and conclusions on the race problem, and then do nothing about it. Negro church women have all of the machinery necessary to enable them to work together and do not need nor want any type of separate council set up for them. And what is more, we will not have them. Catherine Smith in 1942. She represents but the dynamic, but one of the women of dynamism of that period. In that period, we also have Mrs. Bethune, Anne Arnold Hedgeman, Oakley Maxwell Sr., Mrs. Benjamin Mays. Mrs. Bethune was Baptist and then became, she was educated by the Presbyterians. Anne Arnold Hedgeman was nothing and then became a Baptist. Mrs. Oakley Maxwell is a Baptist. Mrs. Mays is a Baptist. Mrs. David Jones of that period is the United Methodist from North Carolina. Mrs. Abby Clement Jackson of the African Methodist Episcopal Church was very outstanding in Church Women United in 1944 to 1950. Mrs. Charles Johnson, the president of the FIST, was the United African Methodist Episcopal Zion person in that period, leading the women of this nation. In the Disciples of Christ, we have Rosa Page Welch. In the African Methodist Episcopal Church, we have Anna Heath. And in the American Baptist, we have Mrs. Jessie Jane McNeil. And in the African Methodist Episcopal, Mrs. D. Ward Nichols. And I could go on and I'll bring in some of the others later. In 1945, I was chosen to be one of five national church youth leaders to attend the World Conference in London, England, a conference in Prague, Czechoslovakia, and a youth conference in the USSR. It was a five-month experience, but Christian Youth of the World had in 1947 a Harlem young adult named Dorothy Arian Height as its representative to the World Christian Conference in Oslo, Norway, of the World Council of Churches. The AME Church sent Rena Weller, Karika Smog, whom I saw here today, their national youth president in Waterbury, Connecticut, to that conference. So in the middle 40s, Black church Christian youth were participant leaders in world conferences, discovering the problems of colonialism, power, hunger, lack of education, and racial discrimination. The New York State Christian Youth Council, predominantly white, had a Black president from 1946 to 1949, whose name was Olivia Pearl Stokes. And in 1953, Olivia Stokes became the first Black woman director of the outstanding Massachusetts Council of Churches Department of Religious Education and served there in the predominantly 1.5 million Protestants for 14 years. Appointment to this ecumenical position illustrated the value of local Christian education programs in the Black church. When I was a child, our family moved north after the death of my father, I was 7, and joined the Abyssinian Baptist Church, which was in 1925. The first Black church in New York City, and maybe in the United States of America, to have a Black religious educator, a Yale graduate with a master's degree in religious education. And through the years, from 1928 to 1960, Abyssinian Baptist Church gave to the world Dorothy Irene Height, Gladys Thorne, Olivia Pearl Stokes, Judge Robert Mangrum, Leon Sullivan, and many other young men in the clergy today. Dr. Adam Clayton Powell Sr. believed in formal religious education for members of his congregation and especially for youth. The most significant act of the period between 1942 to 1960 was the refusal of a Black church woman speaking out of deep Christian conviction, saying no to racial discrimination on a bus in Montgomery, Alabama. The spiritual fallout from this event on this nation and the world will be felt for generations yet unborn around the world. moral leader based on the act of a black church woman. Christian youth sprang from classrooms to sit-ins. Black church masses supported by them inspired its white youth and clergy and led this nation in mass demonstrations for economic justice, education, social equality, and political justice. When in 1957, Rosa Parks, as a guest in my home, was asked the question, what gave her the strength and the fortitude to take her stand, she replied in her quiet, strong way, my 2 weeks experience at an interracial Christian conference at the Hollinger Education and Research Center in Newmarket, Tennessee, or for short, the Hollinger Folk School. Christian faith had been exercised in that experience. Interracial activity had given strength to her faith, and power to act was Mrs. Parks' response. In the period between 1960 and 1979, I call this period a backward glance and a forward thrust in the United States. The Poor People's Campaign in D.C., the passage of the Civil Rights and the Voting Rights Bill, the significant leadership of the National Council of Churches Commission on Religion and Race, the outstanding work led by Dr. Wilmore in the Presbyterian Church, all had the unsung support of mostly unknown black church women. Dr. Ann Arnold Hedgman, during this period, rediscovered the church, the black church, and the white church, and finding value and vitality and power there gave vital leadership to the liberation freedom efforts. I'll never forget Ann Arnold Hedgman had been a paw against the black church like the other Paul had been against the Christian. And when she suddenly found the faith because the church was working for human rights, she got on a plane and came up to Boston where I was. And came into my office and apologized for her damning the church through the centuries. And I just sat there in utter silence and said to her, separate the institutionalism of the church and all of its evils from Jesus Christ whom we worship through God. And then you can go on and do what he requires of us in this time. This period may be said to be significant for black church women because of the changes that were forced as a result of the civil rights and the women's liberation movement. The focus now is on organizational change that would admit black church women to be policy decision makers and top church administrators. It is interesting to note that the ecumenical bodies have opened up more than the denomination. In the National Council of Churches, a black Presbyterian woman, Emily Gibbs, heads as executive director the Division of Education and Ministry. And Dr. Dorothy Irene Hite, a United Methodist, is vice president, is one of the vice presidents. The World Council of Churches is presently searching for a black African or third world woman to be a deputy general secretary and to work with the Central Committee. On the Central Committee, several black women serve, representing many denominations. United Church Women has had denominational representatives as black church women on its board and capable black program staff on the National Local Leadership Committee. United Presbyterian Church selected Dr. Thelma Adair to be its national moderator in 1976 and 1977. Mrs. Patterson, a black church woman with an international background, heads their Washington, D.C. National Social Political Lobby Office today. Dr. Pearl McNeil now serves as the ecumenical staff person for the American Baptist Churches. The CME, the AME, the AMEZ, and the Baptists all have black church women on major committees of their denomination and the National Council of Churches. Yet few are appointed or elected to the boards of the seminaries or church colleges. It is traditional with black denominations. 1979, but the cracks are now evident. One of the largest and most vital ministries in the United Methodist Church is the Woman's Division, which is headed by Teresa Hoover, an innovative, dynamic Black church woman of vision, faith, and action. Theological seminaries are now ministering in their student bodies to the call of Black church women for education in the ministry. And the number studying is significant, but the calls to local congregations as assistants, associates, or pastors are very limited indeed. And going to be more limited since Baptists listen to the Pope and not to God. The recent pronouncement of the Pope didn't help to change this traditional situation. Black denominational caucuses within Black and white denominations are now including in their membership and concerns the Black church women. I guess I ought to say, parenthetically, that there is a distinction between the Black women and their struggle for equality, and they're joining movements of women for equality, and the white woman. The white woman, in her struggle, represents the need to get rid of her second-class status, but she has had the privilege of an economically viable way of life through her husband's work, her suburban home, or her good apartment in the urban setting, and the good schools for her children. So she wants freedom for herself from the responsibilities that have been required sociologically in an American culture. I wonder sometimes as I sit in churches of all Black denominations whether the Black woman doesn't really feel the need for a king symbol in the Black pastor as an evidence of her need to fulfill her own desire for a man who has a position that could support his family, for a man who has status that can give him distinction in the community and in the membership, for a man who can provide the tenderness and the love that every human wants from another human being, whatever your sexual preference. This hunger for enough Black men who have been given the opportunity for full equality is absent in the Black community. And so there is a differential that needs to be examined. I've just come from a week of meetings of the New York State Empire Convention. And one of the washroom conversations is, you know, about that new mink cape that some woman is wearing. And to hear women say, "My husband bought this for me as a gift for my anniversary," is different than 10 years ago when that woman had to buy that cape out of her own earnings. And it's indication that the economic status of the Black male is stronger today for the Black church woman to have the luxuries of life than it was 20 or 30 years ago. But to give you another illustration from the conference of 2 weeks ago in Rochester, in discussing family life, Black church women were saying, "It's my money, and it's not his money I work for." And I said, "Would not the Christian approach be something like this? Or could this be a Christian approach? Our money for the family is in one bank account. His money for doing whatever he wants, whether she approves of it or not, is in his own bank account. And her money for doing what she wants, whether anybody approves of it, is in another bank account. and reflection as a basis for being in mission and ministry. And when this paper gets rewritten, it will say, among other things that have been omitted because of time, that the black church has not engaged anybody, women or men, in a study of the scriptures on a planned, intelligent basis. And so women today are saying, if we are in mission and ministry, let's talk about it, let's study it, and let's do it in terms of a conference. The second recommendation is that the National Council sponsor or call a national seminar or workshop on Christian education. Again, the woman's concern for the children and the adults in Christian ministry is to be seen as helping to equip the saints of the church for ministry and mission. Three, that the National Council of Churches Task Force on Ethnic Women of Color in Ministry place renewed emphasis on strategies and action to provide church workers with a listing of women in national, regional, and local advocacy positions for the empowerment of women within their respective denominations, not only as clergy, but as women who are in decision-making, as women who see the church as a vital advocacy of the kind of philosophy that will change America and build the kingdom of God on earth. Four, that the National Council reach out to women in ministry in storefronts and independent churches and organizational structures and invite them into full participation in the mainline Christian communities. Five, that denominations begin now to plan for full-time employment of its ordained ethnic women of color, of its directors of religious education, and other women certified for Christian ministry with salaries and fringe benefits commensurate with their training and experience, and internship or field placement to be provided interdenominationally for seminaries who are training ethnic women of color. I'll never forget one day, the phone rang in my office in New York when I was with the American Baptist in the Harlem area, serving 157 churches. And one of the most distinguished Brooklyn pastors, a man who has been teaching at all our major theological schools on preaching, called me in through his secretary and asked if I'd come and be one of the candidates he would like to consider for director of religious education. I was finishing my PhD. The first woman in America, I guess I was the first black woman in America in 1952 to get a PhD in religion. And he told his secretary to tell me that my salary would be $4,000. He had a BS and something. And he was getting $8,000 or $10,000. So I didn't answer the phone call, I just let it go. And about 2 weeks later, I got another call. But this time the call came through my director, and the director came and asked me if I didn't know that I was wanted by this minister. And I said, oh. And the second time, I was told that he wanted to see me. And I said, thanks, will you tell him to pick up the phone and call me? I haven't got that call yet. But I sent word back that if a minister with a BS was wanting a director with a PhD, $4,000 wouldn't do it. one comes first in priority. And Teachers College, Columbia University, where I graduated at the top of the doctoral class, asked if I would become an associate professor. And what they had wanted me to do was to set up their National Urban Institute. And what was this for? This was really to help their white graduates with PhDs cope with black education across America and school system. And I said to them, it's rather tragic that you give cadence to your white professors who write books, that when they use them, they can't deal with their situations in the local community. I've written two. I haven't had time to write the other five that are now yours are being sold at $275, not $895. And your men can't handle the situation. And so unless I get appointed as a full-time professor, I'm not coming. And they handed me a contract as associate professor. And I handed the contract back to the dean unsigned, saying, and they had asked me what I wanted for salary, and I said, I don't know, whatever you pay your faculty. They said, that's refreshing, because black men come in, and they want to demand non-negotiable. I said, I'm not, whatever you pay is okay by me, but just be sure that it's equal. Because if it isn't equal, then you have a lawsuit on your hand. I handed back the associate professor's statement and contract, walked out of Columbia University saying, I'm not hungry. And one of the top black men called me and said, you're the first woman, not black woman, you're the first woman that ever walked out of Columbia University and returned a contract unsigned. And I said, I serve a God that doesn't require me to accept discrimination of sexism as a way to live. In summary, black church women have been supported to theologies, not their own, those of their pastors. They've been supported to the civil rights movement and human rights programmatic efforts, always initiated by organizations within the black community and not planned by the churches. Black church women as membership have had few study experiences in theology, black or otherwise. An examination of the nature of the activity within the churches of black denominations might reveal that a disproportionate amount of time and energy of church women is spent in fundraising. It's interesting to note that the Methodists, in their connectional structure, have had more women involved in filling the spots that had to be filled according to their philosophy than the other denominations. An examination of the ecclesiastical concerns of black church women would say that the future for black church women in the black church will depend on how effectively the faith is related or interfaced with the life situations and problems of today's black people. The black church women hold hope, held hope in the past. God willing, the future will also be here.
Then respond to each accordingly. I believe that she gave us a believe that the framework that she has set for us in terms of a historical perspective is critical in terms of informing us from whence we have come, in terms of forming an attitudinal reference frame from where we are. What I would like to do at this juncture is lift those same issues in terms of trying to discover where it is, in fact, that we are going, if in fact we're going anywhere. Sister Stokes has said that black women, as church women, have been invisible in most histories, whether those written by black people or whether they are written about black people. The trauma is not that black women are invisible in those histories, but even in the church, black women are not yet visible to themselves. Something is operative in our belief system that fails to make contact with us at the point of our womanhood. And so it is unclear to the black believer, who is for the most part a woman, what it means to be a woman in Christ. So much of what we have written and so much of what we have sung capsule this belief. She has said that were it not for black church women, there would be no black church. What troubles me is not only that a true description, but it is also an indictment. I have to raise the question, what kind of pastoring is being done to us such that in our being pastored, we never touch base with the fact that we are women? And if we are the preponderant numbers in the congregation, what is the content of our witness that all of these years we have failed to bring to Christ our husbands, our lovers, our friends, and our sons? And so when we look at the statement, were it not for black church women, there would be no black church, it becomes clear to us that we are not yet the church. What we find is a body of believers meshed into an experience where they are to make contact with God, but not yet. And so we have in the ritual of the black church an event in which the God is far from us, and who we are is significantly different from what we are called to be. For example, if you perceive on any Sunday morning in any of the denominations that she has mentioned, you'll see a sister in her white usher uniform marching proudly down the aisles of every church because she really would rather be a doorkeeper in the house. But on Monday morning, that sprint to the music becomes a very lethargic drag through the food style line. In another context, you have a very powerful, dynamic, sanctified, cold, fruit-bearing witness who is, for all intents and purposes, the pillar of the church, a church which she can never pastor, howsoever. It's only what you do for Christ will last. same prayers that our grandmothers prayed. Oh Lord, have mercy. We have two options. Evil A, we are serving a capricious God who has no concern for his creation, or B, he has already had mercy and nobody told us. Sister Stokes says that the concerns of Black church women are faith, family welfare, and human dignity. I believe that those are secondary concerns in light of the fact that I believe that the Black woman primarily would know God. Not in some abstract epiphenomena, but in terms of her self-definition and understanding of who she is and what is her purpose in life. And so it really doesn't matter if her husband is a member of the Society for the Study of Black Religion, or if she doesn't have any husband, but if that woman at a critical point in her learning to know God makes contact with him in such a way that she knows who she is, this is her primary concern. And it really doesn't matter then about what the society or any system has to say, because the woman has been set free. The struggle that we walk with is what we see evident here. The Black church is predominantly woman. The theologians are predominantly men. And this lets us know that the relationship between theology and the church is as common law as most of our marriages. Sister Stokes says that the focus now is our organizational change that would admit Black church women to be policy decision makers and top church administrators. I would say, from the glimpses that we have had of who we are, when we really are the church, that no woman who knows God would really want to preside over this chaos that we have now. The focus is not on being involved and getting a position in this context of fear faithlessness. We have ceased to be and even ceased to strive to become the church. And we have given back to God rituals and ceremonies in place of being the militating body of Christ in the world, that wars with the world, that the world through us might be changed. She says that the National Council of Churches Consultation of Ethnic Women in Ministry recommends these ecclesiastical concerns. And in summary, I would say they are these: a consultation, a seminar, a directory, a sisterhood, employment, none of which we are called to, none of which set us free in such a way that we can be God's evidence in the world. And so the struggle of black women. I've summarized five. The ecclesiastical concerns of the black church must be A, formulating a witness, the content of which meets the believer and the world at the point of their greatest need. If I will represent the black woman, then I say that the church and I, with ourselves, war against that fear, faithlessness, that we might have a risk encounter with the will and values of the world that is beyond symbol to event. We have to stop sending so much mail. We have to begin to be God's now. We who seek justice have got to stop acting as though justice is something apart from us and realize that in this instance, we are called to take our blessings by force. We have ceased to understand who we are. We are the persecuted church. The assault upon us is damnable, not because we are black, beloved, but because we are the church. And I contend that if we got sufficiently indignant, realizing that this assault upon us is an assault upon the church of God, that our methodologies and response systems would be completely different. Because at the level of our blackness, we respond to our condition from a material sense. More money, more jobs, more housing. But that is not what it is at all. We are called to be God's evidence to the world that He has a providential plan that is operative, that He is going to make manifest in the black woman who in this hour constitutes that body of black believers, which is called the church. This is not some vague opinion I'm giving to you. Jeremiah knew that this was going to come to pass. And that is why he said, "Behold, I do a new thing in all the earth. A woman shall protect a man." Secondly, in terms of ecclesiastical concerns, we must begin coalescing in the global effort toward redemption. We are in, if not with, the world. Too many of our bodies of black believers think that God has called us to and glued us to some corner in some city street. But we are in the world, if not with the world. And we, like Habakkuk, have to begin to see the whole. In other words, what is the purpose of being a black believer in 1979 in North America? I submit that it has not just merely to do with Detroit and Chicago and Harlem, but it has to do with the global plan that God has for redemptive activity to usher in the kingdom of God. And as long as we're reacting to being in this corner, we miss the whole thing. The question becomes, whether in fact the whole canon is not really just a big parable pointing beyond itself the black church live more by ritual and ceremony than by definition. In carrying out